Talk given Friday, 7th February, 1975. The lovelessness, the violence, and the sense of not belonging with which thousands of people are all too familiar in the world today has its roots in our own ignorant state. We do not see clearly, and seeing clearly in this context means at the same time feeling profoundly that we are integral part and parcel of the whole of organic life in this world. Not only of organic life, but of the whole world, the entire cosmos as such. We are intensely, separatively conscious. This is one of our root troubles. This separative self-consciousness. We never look into this. We never try to understand this deeply enough. So, right in the depths of our consciousness, we are cut off from the world. Without paying any attention to that or waking up to that fact, we try out various techniques to counteract the consequence of that separativeness. In terms of feeling not wanted, in terms of the violence and hate, the loneliness, the misery, which is everywhere around us and which we experience ourselves. Now these countermeasures can go on forever and ever. One can go on trying them forever and ever and never bring about the right state of affairs. Because, as I said, at the very root is this separative self-consciousness. And this is due fundamentally to our ignorance of ourselves. Now, to what extent have we failed, even conventionally, orthodoxly, to live up to the teachings of the great teachers? Because their concern was essentially our fruition as human beings. This is a very important point to bear in mind. This is what they were concerned with. And it was in the old days put in the form of relating us rightly to God, to some transcendent power, to the ultimate reality, and so forth. What was one of their, perhaps their most important and outstanding teaching? It was to be harmless. Not to take life. Thou shalt not commit murder. the Buddhist form, psychologically so sound, presents it as abstention from all harming. And of course, the most important aspect of that harming is the taking of life. Abstain from taking life. And you remember how the Buddha expands that when he talks about himself. Here are his actual words in one of the long discourses. Putting away the killing of living things, Gautama holds aloof from the destruction of life. He has laid the cudgel and the sword aside, and ashamed of roughness and full of mercy, he dwells compassionate and kind to all creatures that have life. A little later, he goes on to say, Gautama holds himself aloof from causing injury to seeds or plants. And further on, he goes on to say, whereas some recluses and Brahmins, while living on food provided by the faithful, continue addicted to the injury of seedlings and growing plants, whether propagated from roots or cuttings or joints or buddings or seeds. Gautama holds aloof from such injury to seedlings and growing plants. I couldn't find the exact context, but I believe I have read in one of the texts a reference to the habit some people have that when they are walking in woodlands of slashing away at leaves and branches with sticks and destroying them. Now this was taught 25 centuries ago. It was taught before his day too. Not so explicitly as he taught it. The Buddhist teachings in these matters are far more explicit and forthright as compared with the ethical precepts or commandments in practically all the other religions. But now I would like to read to you what modern science is discovering. This is only 2 pages out of scores of pages which is a remarkably instructive sermon on harmlessness. These are scientific facts. It comes from Dr. Lyle Watson's book Supernature. He's a biologist, and he's something of a distinguished scientist, has produced books and so forth. On a February morning in 1966, Cleve Baxter made a discovery that changed his life and could have far-reaching effects on ours. Baxter was at that time an interrogation specialist who left the CIA to operate a New York school for training policemen in the techniques of using the polygraph or lie detector. If anyone told lies, this instrument recorded changes in the organism which told their own tale. This instrument normally measures the electrical resistance of the human skin, but on that morning he extended its possibilities. Immediately after watering an office plant, he wondered if it would be possible to measure the rate at which water rose in the plant from the root to the leaf by recording the increase in leaf moisture content on a polygraph tape. Baxter placed the two psychogalvanic reflex electrodes. Psychogalvanic reflex for short is just PGR. The two PGR electrodes on either side of a leaf of Dracaena on either side of a leaf of Dracaena Massangiana, a potted rubber plant, and balance the leaf into the circuitry before watering the plant again. There was no marked reaction to this stimulus, so Baxter decided to try what he calls the threat to well-being principle, a well-established method of triggering emotionality in humans. In other words, he decided to torture the plant. First of all, he dipped one of its leaves into a cup of hot coffee, but there was no reaction. So he decided to get a match and burn the leaf properly. Note, he didn't actually burn it, he decided to do that. Baxter writes now, at the instant of this decision, at 13 minutes and 55 seconds of chart time, there was a dramatic change in the PGR tracing pattern in the form of an abrupt and prolonged upward sweep of the recording pen. I had not moved or touched the plant, so the timing of the PGR pen activity suggested to me that the tracing might have been triggered by the mere thought of the harm I intended to inflict on the plant. Baxter went on to explore the possibility of such perception in the plant by bringing some live brine shrimp into his office and dropping them one by one into boiling water. Every time he killed a shrimp, the polygraph recording needle attached to the plant jumped violently. To eliminate the possibility of his own emotions producing this reaction, he completely automated the whole experiment so that an electronic randomizer chose odd moments to dump the shrimp into hot water when no human was in the laboratory at all. The plant continued to respond in sympathy to the death of every shrimp and failed to register any change when the machine dropped already dead shrimp into the water. Impressed by the plant's apparent sensitivity to stress, Baxter collected specimens of other species and discovered that a philodendron seemed to be particularly attached to him. He no longer handles this plant with anything but the greatest care, and whenever it is necessary to stimulate it in order to produce a reaction, his assistant, Bob Henson, plays the heavy. Now the plant produces an agitated polygraph response every time Henson comes into the room and seems to relax when Baxter comes near or even speaks in an adjoining room. Enclosing the plant in a Faraday screen or a lead container has no effect, and it seems that the signals to which it responds do not fall within the normal electromagnetic spectrum. In more recent experiments, Baxter has found that fresh fruit and vegetables, mold cultures, amoebae, paramecia, yeast, blood, and even scrapings from the roof of a man's mouth all show similar sensitivity to other life in distress. This phenomenon, which Baxter calls primary perception, has been substantiated by repetition of his work in other laboratories. It raises awesome biological and moral questions. Since thinking about it, I, for one, have had to give up mowing lawns altogether. But if it were to be taken to its logical limits, we would end up like the community in Samuel Butler's Erewhon, eating nothing but cabbages that have been certified to have died a natural death. The answer to the moral problem lies in treating all life with respect and killing with real reluctance only that which is necessary for survival. But the biological problems are not as easily resolved. Now, this is something quite extraordinary, is it not? You see how the living world is sensitive. It knows. And it feels this extraordinary sympathy with all life. This whole book is full of the most remarkable scientific evidence gathered over years and years to show the truth of this sensitivity in living creatures. We humans, so-called, are the supreme predators in this world. Now I ask you, do we not suffer from violence upon us, lovelessness, loneliness, not wantedness? At least partly because we are insensitive to others. If I am insensitive to you, Is there not a tendency in you to be insensitive to me? In the ordinary way in the world, this is what we observe, the tit for tat, uncontrollable reaction. I remember very well, years ago, in the early 1940s, when I first read through that Brahmajala Sutta, with the Buddha's teachings, very carefully, completely through, every single word. As a matter of fact, I've been through all the discourses since then, like that, very carefully. When I first read that, I was really skeptical. I thought, this is carrying the matter far too far, is it not? It's absurd. Why go to such extremes? We know also how much, for instance, doctors who run hospitals in countries like India resent the trouble to which they are put because of the Hindu custom of not killing so many monkeys and so forth on the hospital grounds, who do a lot of damage all around. Then people rather despise the Jains who sweep the extremely orthodox ones, will carry a broom and sweep the path in front of them in order to remove any living creatures which may be trodden upon. Of course, in the modern world, all that seems quite absurd. And of course, the people who do that perhaps do it merely because they are blindly obeying something which has been laid down. They are not inwardly sensitive. Intellectually, they will give the reason that, oh, we might tread upon living creatures and kill them. And that's wrong. But now here we come across science showing the extent to which harmlessness applies throughout the living world. We talk about nature red in tooth and claw. But that is a partial observation. And consider this redness in tooth and claw. The beasts of prey do not exercise thoughtless, deliberate cruelty. They have no concentration camps. They have no ruthless murders in order to obtain their desired ends or to establish a type of government which they think is the right type of government and so forth. They don't do that at all. And when a beast of prey kills its prey, it's purely for food, and as soon as it has done that, all is quiet and at peace again. Now, the animal world can do that and live sensitively to an extent that we haven't begun to catch up with. Is it not surprising, therefore, that we suffer from so much violence and so forth? Now, there comes another aspect into this situation with regard to us human beings. we as human beings have to live not only mechanically sensitive, just obeying the laws of nature. After all, the animal world and the insect world and the plant world more or less respond quite naturally. They have little option in the matter, deliberately to perform an act of cruelty. We have option, we have choice. So not only have we to live harmlessly in the natural sense, through exercising natural sensitivities, but we have to introduce the element of conscious action in the direction of positive loving kindness, compassion, and so forth. By and large, animals just leave the sick alone. They might do something. Tell me, am I right or wrong in the matter? But I think it is a fact, is it not, that animals are not capable of deliberately attending to the sick, to responding to calls of distress and so on, to the extent and in the manner in which human beings are. Isn't that so? All right. So we have to add that on to it. Now, if we add that on with an egoistic, separative self-consciousness, we are souring the grapes, aren't we? We are doing it because, oh, I'm a good fellow, and I've got to do the right thing. I'm an English gentleman, I'm a Christian, or I'm a Hindu, or whatever it is, and therefore, I do it. No. It is the law of the true human that he will be loving and compassionate, considerate, and so forth. This is the human law. But it is not a law which is imposed from outside. It is something which becomes our spontaneous way of life. Now it is in order that such a thing may become a spontaneous way of life that some of those old methods were presented. We talked about the Brahma Viharas last time, just towards the end of our meeting. And here, of course, what is emphasized is the meditative practice in which one directs in thought loving kindness, metta, compassion, karuna, and so forth to other people, to the teacher, to your friends, to those who are indifferent to you, to those who are your enemies too. There are two groups mentioned specifically to whom you should not direct any loving kindness or any thought of love when you start. One is to a member of the opposite sex. Because until the nature is purified, it has been discovered through actual experience, one's passions are very strongly roused, and your last condition is far worse than your first, as well as the other person's condition. Later on, with proficiency, with inward poise, and natural freedom from being dominated by passion, one can direct metta and karuna to anybody and everybody, including your enemies. So, member of the opposite sex and your enemies, really hostile people, must be left alone. Because you get the reaction later, a little later, rising up from the unconscious of hate for the enemy. And you will find yourself caught up in a storm of anger and hate and the terrible things you'll do to that enemy. That is why this is done. Now, you may recollect how often I have said, what does one do when one attempts something like this? Is it not a mere verbal ritual with most people? Now, it is a fact, is it not, that when we attempt deliberately to do this as a technique for spreading love and for developing love in us, it is just a verbal mumble at first. The genuine feeling, which is the genuine energy, psychical energy of love, is not really at play. It's easy enough to let your emotions flow out if the other person happens to be someone whom you like very much, you love very much, so forth. But then, that is more an emotional indulgence rather than anything else. And if the other person is very dear to one, one gets very upset inside at the thought, the idea of that person suffering anything at all. All sorts of complications arise. So it is not emotionalism in which one has to indulge, or one should allow oneself to indulge. Why is it that we find it so difficult to practice these Brahma Viharas, these divine abidings, from the word go? We set about it in the wrong way. In the first place, what are the obstructions within us? This is what we have to consider carefully. And this is the thing that is usually, well, perhaps not usually, but all too often, omitted by meditation teachers. One starts with considering the evils of violence, the evils of hate, not the other fellow's violence and the other fellow's hate, my own violence, my own hate. To what extent am I violent? To what extent am I hating? And how do I express that in my everyday life? Consider how easy it is to be precipitated into fantasies of anger and violence, saying all sorts of nasty things in imagination to your husband or wife, or one doesn't usually to one's child, but because he's a child and you have a sense of power there, and you don't feel it so strongly. But anyone who is your equal or stronger than you, or who touches your heart deeply, how easy it is to go off into these terrible hate fantasies. You see? It is there, is it not? Now, the mere intellectual consideration of these things is not enough. Because the brain, especially in our modern world, is so well trained we read such a lot, we know such a lot, we are told such a lot, that we can easily go through another mumble of words. We can easily indulge in our guilt complex having full sway. What a bad fellow I am, and this, that, and the other. The terrible things I think of, and I mustn't do it, and I must change my ways and turn over a new leaf. And having made a long speech for 3 hours with that sort of fantasy, the very next time that the dog barks, you say, "Damn that dog, can't he keep quiet?" And off we are again. Now look, all this sounds frightfully trivial. It sounds frightfully trivial. But it is extraordinary that it is the little things, the smallest things, the apparently insignificant and trivial things that make up the entire universe. What is the universe built up of? Dust. Specks of dust. Insignificant? Trivial? Useless? Not worth bothering about? But that's what I am made up of. Dust. So let us not say that, this is all very trivial, and push it aside. The great scholars read these, what they not unnaturally call boring, detailed homilies, moral discourses of the Buddha or any of the great teachers, and say, they were an awful lot of old bores. Yes, an awful lot of all bores to me, who am subhuman. And not only content, but active in remaining subhuman, and possibly sinking deeper into the evil, the strangulating evil of subhumanity. So, we have to consider this all along the line. This is where mindfulness comes in. Watch how it comes up and see it. Keep poised as much as possible when it comes up. Don't feel, I failed. Let the word I be out of it altogether. This is what is happening. This is the kind of thing that is producing pain and misery to me and to everybody else. Really see it, and as you steadily see and see, you will feel it also with tremendous intensity. But the two have to be there together, particularly the seeing, because it is the seeing which produces ultimately the release from this bondage, this prison house of our own evil inside us. Once the seeing is really clear and strong, a very strong seeing that this is the fact, then any time the stimulus comes up, the situation comes up which is provocative, your immediate reaction is not one of hate, of violence, of anger. Because you know, no, this doesn't work at all, this is the wrong thing. This only makes the whole situation much worse. You see, it is as if you are cooking something on a gas which is too high and the food is beginning to burn. And you don't save the situation by turning the gas up still higher. But that is just the kind of thing that we humans do. We make the situation worse. So, see the thing, keep on seeing, be patient, and be forbearing. And in this connection with of the Brahma Viharas, the first part of the meditative practice consists in becoming more and more clearly aware of the ills of violence and hate, and then seeing the value of patience and forbearance. And then there, with years of practice, there comes the point when the psychical nature is sufficiently pure, sufficiently poised and stable to allow the meditator to enter quietly into the state of equanimity and real good feeling rises up by itself. It will rise up by itself. You can't compel it. You can't summon it. You can't order it. No one can order love. It's impossible. Then it begins to cease to be a mere mumble of words. Because by the time the psyche has been purified that far, both body and psyche are in a healthy state, in a happy state. And in the happy state, psychophysically, you feel benevolent, friendly, kindly towards everybody around you, don't you? Now note carefully. We all, during our lives, time and again, feel this happy state. And we feel benevolent and kindly. And somebody comes along and says something, or some news comes along, and upsets us, as we say. And we react badly again. Why? We are not yet free from our isolative, separative self-consciousness. Therefore, we are not free of egoism. He hurt me. No. If I am a separate ego, then I can be psychically hurt, bodily hurt, whether I'm the perfected holy one or the most awful villain in the world. The bodily hurt is bodily hurt for both, but the psychical aspect, this is the important thing, because it is this which affects the change. It's the psyche which is the receptacle of sensitivity. Now, when the psyche is poised and the mind is awake, it is not isolatively self-conscious, it doesn't function egoistically, then when you're feeling benign and kindly and somebody comes and does the wrong thing, you just absorb it quite easily. You see, this man's behaving like this. Well, all right. You are not upset. You do not react back against him. But something else actually happens now. And it happens spontaneously. The springs of compassion actually flow out of your whole being, your whole psychophysical being, outwards. You don't sort of counteract his ill. This is a very important point. Because you see, counteracting is like taking drugs in order to counteract the ill, the symptoms, the pain of wrong living, caused by mistakes in food, work, whatever it is. Wrong living, you see. Counteraction is no good. You do not counteract that person. But it is like the slow and steady effect of lovely sunshine or a cool breeze, and the living organism in time responds to it and feels at peace and happy. And that is the way we can affect the other person. Now, in doing this, who is most affected? Who is the person who is the greatest, who is most benefited? Oneself. When this has become part of one's life, one never feels loveless, unloved. Because one is not demanding love, one is not asking for love. How can I ask or demand love? It's impossible, it's absurd. One doesn't feel lonely, cut off. I may have no one around me for days and weeks. I may be by myself in a room only, or by myself in the open, alone, as we say. But I'm not lonely. Why? Isolative self-consciousness is not there. One is awake to relationship with anything and everything. Look, if the leaf of a plant can be so sensitive, so awake, that when a live shrimp is killed, it reacts in sympathy. If a leaf of a plant can do that, how shameful it is if I, supposed to be a human being, haven't got anything near that sensitivity. Now you see, all this has effects which we can never measure. They talk about the world's problems all over the world. They talk about the world's problems. And a million different people produce million different plans and schemes to solve the problems. They are all utterly useless. Utterly useless. The results they produce, which groups of people consider good, are results which satisfy the egoism, the vanity, the sense of security, the conceit, the pleasure lust of those groups. And all these things are the very things that produce the world's problems and our own individual problems. So all these are utterly useless. The problem is myself. The problem is not even the circumstantial problems which afflict me, which come to me. It's not even that. The problem is right inside my own consciousness, in my own psyche. The way I'm aware of existence, of the world. I'm aware of, if I'm aware of it, as a not self, something separate, something from which I have to fight and wrest a livelihood and security and pleasure and comfort and success and all the nonsense, then there is everlasting misery. But if I am inwardly in touch and in sympathy with the world, although pain will inevitably come, because that's the nature of things, physical pain anyway, illness and so forth, it'll all come. And pain emotionally, caused because those dear to you are suffering, because they are deliberately doing wrong and so forth, all those things cause inward suffering, yes? Although that happens, there is that inner freedom from suffering, from unnecessary sorrow. And if you are free from the burden of unnecessary sorrow, then you can, by virtue of your mere existence in the world, the mere fact of your existence, be a blessing to your environment. And this is love. Something which you and I don't know. No one can put love on a silver salver and present it to you for your examination and say, here, look, this is love. The day may come when science may be able actually to penetrate the mystery of life so much that it will actually produce life out of inorganic matter and so forth, and show you the whole technique and the whole process and say, look, this is life. But it will be next to impossible to say, look, this is love. It's a mystery. Be clean. Be patient, forbearing, free of inward violence and hate. Free of separative, isolative self-consciousness. Awake to the relationship with everything. And this mystery of love will flood into your life. And then circumstance around also changes. In a curious way, it changes. I don't know how it changes, but it does. I know from my own living experience that it does. That is why I have said for several years now that the most powerful influence at work in changing your circumstance is your innermost state of consciousness. And that is something which has no shape, no form. You can't see it. You can't pursue it inside yourself and say, ah, that's my innermost consciousness. You can't do it. You can do the cleansing work. And through the cleansing work and the awakening to the fact that there is only one total reality, one universe, a great, thrilling, living, wonderful organism. When you awake to that, then this conversion inside the soul has taken place, and that is love. And that love will run all your machines better than so-called workers who work the machines. It will run the affairs of state infinitely better and more successfully than all the flounderings of politicians and whatnots. Our democracies are funny pictures drawn by 10th-rate artists. The reality of democracy we don't know at all. We know the external shape of it. This ought to be the machinery of it. But that machinery is invented in order to run human beings, which is the wrong way around. It is the human being who runs the machine. What sort of a human being? Now, this is the important point. If I have a sense of real at-one-ment with my fellow human beings, I can consider with together with them, and they similarly can consider together with me. We can see what is the good and not what I want or what is good for this group or that group. If there is real love and simplicity and purity and so forth, then we shall know how to consider all situations and all things. How do people speak in when they consider together, as they call it, a round table or parliament or anywhere? They're always scoring points one against the other. They can't even speak in a gentlemanly or a ladylike manner, but they shout and they scream and they throw books at each other and goodness knows what. They are like wild animals who have truly gone wild. You'll never get anywhere this way. The Buddha presented the shape of democratic procedure 25 centuries ago. I was so delighted when in the late 1920s, I read Lord Zetland's books about India. And later on, I had the pleasure of meeting him, and we talked about these things, in which he pointed out that it was the Buddha who laid down the idea of free election of your representatives, having somebody who saw that a quorum was formed, having someone who was chairman of the meetings and so forth, the free discussion. And the Buddha pointed out that one should speak with courtesy, with dignity, and should be listened to with patience and respect. And the standards, the criteria for the discussion should be what conduces to the good of mankind. Do we do anything like that today? Why not? Love is lacking. Understanding is not there. Now you see, this is essentially part of the religious life. If we live religiously, it means that we live humanly, in the true sense of the word human. And then these other problems will just vanish. They just won't exist. We never acknowledge that we are the makers of our problems. We always say, oh, it's the other fellow who's done it. I am the maker of problems. The other fellow is also like me, and therefore he also contributes to the making of the problem. But never mind that fellow. If I can do the right thing, then I have the right influence upon my environment. So you see, this business of the Brahma Viharas, these divine abidings, the sense of unity with the whole. And time and again, the teaching of the divine abidings is given when a seeker suddenly asks the Buddha, show me the way to union with Brahma. Brahma is the Father God, the creator of the universe. Now consider the universe, all this which is created, and how this state of sensitivity, loving-kindness, helpfulness is spread right through nature to a far greater degree than it is in us. Although we have a far, an infinitely greater potentiality for the true thing. So here we see deep significances given out 25 centuries ago, confirmed today throughout nature by modern scientific investigation.